Hello, I'm Mike Babbins. This is number 0535, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0535. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Chris Barber, a television writer and producer who has worked on such shows as CBS's Criminal Minds.
They've done a lot of different kinds of crazy crimes and crazy criminal minds. It was getting harder to surprise the audience or take it on a different journey. Not that there aren't more stories to tell, but it becomes challenging. I think people who don't like those shows, the procedurals they're called, sometimes think like, well, it's the same show every week. There are aspects of that are true, but really, I mean, I think if you're a fan, you would say that they're very different. Because also the characters have evolved, the actors are bringing new things to it. So, but it was the burden more of like, we want it to seem fresh each season. And that is, I think, the challenge.
And Andrew, author of What They Don't Tell You in Prenatal Class, is back on the program talking about happy childhoods. Is that a reality or a myth?
The real key to happiness is understanding that we have inherent worth to the exclusion of all the other ideas about ourselves, that we're bad, that we're guilty, that we deserve to be punished, that we don't belong. These are the common ones that everybody seems to have.
Ernie Smith from Tedium talks about the idea newspapers once had about sending their product via fax machine.
It actually kind of happened twice. There was a period right before World War II where there were attempts to create a fax machine of sorts that used the radio to basically deliver electronically the news of the day. And then later on, about 50 years later, when fax machines via phone became more common, they started distributing news through that method as well.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, plus, of course, an idiot of the day. The guests later. The person who told you this was show number 0535 was Mike Babbins, the co-owner of Evergreen Cannabis Society in Vancouver, British Columbia. And Mike was also a former co-worker with me in the early radio days. Heck of a guy, and someone who is a lot of fun to be around, with or without cannabis. By the way, you can find out more information about the Evergreen Cannabis Society by going to their website, and you'll find the link on our website at thestufffile.com. Just go to the show number that you just heard Mike mention. See how it comes full circle? And you'll find all the information. Thank you very much, Mike, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? About a year ago, Les and Paula Ainslie of Mosel Bay, South Africa, stumbled upon a novel idea for a new type of spirit which they call Indlovu gin. During a safari, they learn that elephants eat a wide variety of fruits and flowers, but digest less than a third of it. As a consequence, in the elephant dung, you get the most amazing variety of these botanicals, Les Ainslie said. Why don't we let the elephants do the hard work of collecting all of these botanicals, and we will make gin from it? Why indeed? They collected the dung themselves by hand and described their gin's flavor as lovely, wooded, almost spicy, earthy. By the way, Indlovu means elephant in the Zulu language, in case you were curious about that. Each bottle's label notes where the dung was gathered and when. Most people are very keen to actually taste it, Ainslie said. A bottle sells for about $32. Well, clearly, I am not most people. I know an elephant never forgets, so I'm afraid if I drink this stuff, I will also have total recall of drinking this stuff. No, thank you. Okay, I know there is the age-old question of which came first, the chicken or the egg. I've got two stories here, so for the sake of this argument, let's start with the chicken. Oak Creek police arrested a Milwaukee man for allegedly driving drunk with a live chicken on his shoulder. 42-year-old Ernesto Martinez Garnica was cited for drunken driving after a witness saw him driving really reckless and his car swerving all over the road with what they originally believed to be a hawk on his shoulder. When police caught up with the vehicle, they noticed a bird flapping inside. After a closer look, they saw it was a brown chicken, not a hawk, that the suspect decided to bring along for the ride. Police searched the vehicle and also found numerous beer cans. Ernesto was given a field sobriety test, which he failed, netting him his third DWI arrest. The chicken, named Teresa, was placed in the back of the police vehicle with the driver's cousin, who had also been riding in Ernesto's car, just not on his shoulder. Police say Teresa is safe. She was given to the Milwaukee Area Domestic Animal Control Commission, where she's being kept until the owner claims it. Okay, how do we know Ernesto didn't find Teresa crossing the road? Maybe the chicken was working as a navigator. Also, if Ernesto was so drunk that he was driving with a chicken on his shoulder, then how drunk was his cousin in the car that they couldn't drive? So many questions, so few answers. So let's just go to our next story, dealing with the eggs. Which reminds me, boys and girls, this next story, this is another version of The Darwin File.
I am the Grim Reaper. I am death.
42-year-old Subhash Yadav of Jaunpur, India, visited a market to eat eggs with a friend on November 4th, but the two fell into an argument. To settle the dispute, Yadav accepted a challenge to eat 50 eggs in exchange for 2,000 rupees. He ate 41 eggs, but just as he began to eat the 42nd, he collapsed unconscious. He was rushed to hospital but died a few hours later. Doctors claimed Yadav died of overeating, but family members would not comment. Okay, I say he had an existential egg experience and the yolks on him. Also, I'd say his friend won the dispute and, by the way, saved 2,000 rupees. Either way, the tree of life is often self-pruning.
I have come for you.
And let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Christopher Barber has had and continues to have a prolific career as a writer and producer in television. He has been a writer and or producer on such shows as CSI and Criminal Minds, just to name a few. Chris joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you, Peter? How is it going today?
It's going very, very well. I got to say, full disclosure, for those who listen to the show on a regular basis, about a month ago, a little over a month ago, we spoke to your dad, the godfather of reality TV, John Barber, about his new book, Your Mother's Not a Virgin. He's the man, of course, who created Real People. And we had a chat not only on air but off air. And I got to say, if you were to look in the dictionary and look up proud father, you would see John Barber's picture.
You know, I feel very, very fortunate. You know, I think that, I don't know that my father always thought, oh, I wanted to have children when I was growing up. And I could not imagine, and I'm not just saying that because I'm on the air right now. I could not imagine having had a better father in every way. I'm just blessed. I was extremely lucky. Just very supportive, you know, encouraging, always loving. I never, you know, and also critical when I needed him to be. And, you know, as I said, I feel very just lucky. So I'm very, and again, yes, he's very proud, and that makes me feel good. You want to make your father proud.
Well, speaking of which, he, as I mentioned, had a very prolific career in television, did quite a few things, mm-hmm. won Emmys. You went into writing first. Was that something that was a passion for you? Was it something to differentiate from what your dad did? How did you come to writing?
I think that my dad was an inspiration, although my dad did a lot of comedy writing, which I feel I was, you know, I think I'm funny, but I don't think I'm funny like that. And I think that's a true gift. And I really admire comedy writers but I did drama writing and mystery writing. I did fall into, I think writing as a career or show business as a career, my dad had modeled it, like, you know, because he came from nothing. You know, I'm very fortunate. I'm second generation. And just to be able to model that as a career, I think that's. But I was always interested in mystery writing as a kid. I was very fond of Sherlock Holmes and things like that. So I do like to say, like, I enjoy plotting murder or the murder mystery or even spy thriller kind of stuff. So I think the drama writing, I don't know, I would say that it was to distinguish it, but I think that was more something that I gravitated toward, whereas my father had been a stand-up comic, and I didn't think that I had those skills, which I do very much admire, though. I love comedy. I just don't know that I could write in that realm. And as I said, I was drawn to mystery writing.
Well, you said you like plotting murders, and I know on television shows, you have a writer's room where you often get together and pitch ideas as to what you want to do for the characters in any given show. And I'm just curious to know what that process is like when you're all in this writer's room and you're literally pitching death and mayhem. Is there anybody in the room who says, maybe we should call security?
You know, it is funny that most of the people that I've ever worked with, you would never imagine, because of their, I don't know what it is, they're so nice, they're very level-headed people, they're just gentle souls. I guess this possibly is a release for them to imagine the unimaginable, the deviousness of people, the treachery of people. I don't know what it is. So in the writer's room, you think, oh my God, you know, you take a peek at the Criminal Minds writer's room, and you think, oh, these people should be locked up somewhere. But the truth is, they're very nice people, everyone I've ever met. CSI or Criminal Minds. I worked on Crossing Jordan years ago. You know, just wonderful people, very nice people. I don't know what it is. I think a little bit of, like, you know, trying to, for me, some of this kind of writing is like writing, you know, creating like a roller coaster emotionally for the audience so that they get to sort of indulge their fears and confront their fears and touch their fears without actually, you know, facing the reality. Because the reality is always worse. And I think that they're, for me, these are like shadow plays where we get to sort of scare you, but it's like having the safety belt on in the roller coaster. You're tempting death or jumping out of a plane, but you're not really confronting it, but it allows you to appreciate certain things about life or the morality tale often about what we're telling. So. They're surprisingly nice people.
you mentioned CSI, Criminal Minds, Crossing Jordan. You just happened to mention three shows that are in my wheelhouse because I've seen every episode of all those shows. That being said, and I'm focusing on Criminal Minds now because that's coming into the its last season, and been on for season 15. Has there ever been a situation? And you didn't join the show right at the beginning. You joined
I was season 13. I came in the last, what would be, end up being the last three seasons of what will turn out to be the last three seasons of the show, because I had also worked on the spinoff of it originally, Criminal Minds Beyond Borders. So, a couple of the writers who, the showrunner, Erica Messer, she had been on Criminal Minds since the beginning. She did not start as the showrunner, as the executive producer in charge, but she had been a producer that then had been there all the whole time. And then ended the show, actually running the show was my boss. I got there past, you know, when I got there, there was some, you know, it was just a well-oiled machine and a wonderful cast. that I felt was very privileged to get to work with. Well, I'm sad that it went into this last season, because it was a wonderful work environment from the crew that we had and the actors and the writing staff.
Well, the reason why I asked the question is, in a show that is running for so long, and let's be honest, there has been some gruesome aspects to this show. When you're in the writer's room putting this thing together in the latter years of its run, is there a line to walk between either going too far and saying that, oh, well, we've already done that?
Yeah, you know, I think the biggest challenge, I mean, there certainly is a line. You don't want to shock at anything, you know, where we're trying to scare an audience. You don't want to shock them so badly that they turn away and don't want to look. It's that delicate balance of being, so horrible that you can't look away, or like a car accident. I think the bigger challenge, I think for myself, speaking personally, was you come up, I watched, when I got the job, I started watching the show. I binge watched many years of the show, and it seemed like I would write down an idea, you know, that I should do an episode about this. And inevitably, the next episode that I watched was that idea. So it is the burden of, like, they've done a lot of different kinds of crazy crimes and crazy criminal minds. It was getting harder to surprise the audience or take it on a different journey. But I think, you know, not that there aren't more stories to tell, but it becomes challenging. You don't want the audience to feel. I think people who don't like those shows, the procedurals they're called, sometimes think like, well, it's the same show every week. There are aspects of that that are true. But really, I mean, I think if you're a fan, you'd say that they're very different. But because also the characters have evolved, the actors are bringing new things to it. So, but it was the burden more of like, we want it to seem fresh each season. And that is, I think, the challenge.
Season 15.
And I hope we met it.
Yes.
I hope we met
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Season 15 hasn't premiered yet, but when it does come on, it will be the end of the show. So what's next for you? I understand you might be working on something for Netflix?
I am working currently on a show for Netflix that probably won't come out for another year. It's a sort of spy thriller with a sci-fi angle called In From the Cold. And so, yes, I'm currently working on that project. It is interesting because this is the first time with the end of Criminal Minds, you know, we wrapped a few months ago, and I guess this is like working in, that was the first time of getting the cable or streaming aspect where, you know, we produce in the streaming world, you produce all the episodes prior to having it air. Whereas in the network world, we're producing the show as we're writing it and it's airing. So, I'm very curious to see how people react to the last season of Criminal Minds, but it won't air, I don't think, until at least January. it's just an odd feeling. Like, it'll be interesting to tap back into that once people start watching it and responding to it, which will be the same with this show here. We're going to produce it and then have all the episodes out, and it probably won't come out for another year.
I know the natural progression when it comes to writing is you work as a writer, then you work as a writer-producer, and then a showrunner, and then usually you're on to creating your own shows. Is there a show that you'd like to create? Is there an idea? Without giving too much away, because you don't want, you know, people to steal it, but is there a passion project you have that you say, well, I know I've done this, and I know I've done this, but this is what I really want to do?
Well, it's funny you say that. I mean, I have a couple of projects that relate to sort of the mystery world, but I also have, I'm a big sports fan. So there are a couple of sports projects, one related to hockey and one related to baseball that I would like to do. And that those will be challenging, though, because, I'm a genre writer, and sometimes it feels like, well, you know, how can you do this other work, a sports show, for instance? But there are a couple that's sort of the pure passion project, because, as I said, I'm a huge sports fan. Personally, I play golf, and I think my father may have mentioned that in terms of my playing professional golf at a certain point, not at the PGA level, but aspired to that, didn't quite get there. There are a couple sports projects that I think are the business of sports, which I find fascinating as well.
Well, continued success in all that you do. We're going to look forward to the 15th and final season of Criminal Minds when it does go on the air on CBS and here in Canada on CTV. And we'll look forward, we'll have to wait a year, but we'll look forward to In From the Cold coming to us on Netflix.
Yes, thank you so much.
Television writer-producer Christopher Barber. He's currently working on a new mystery series for Netflix that won't be out for about a year or so, but we'll have him back on when he can give us some details about the new show called In From the Cold. In the meanwhile, you can look forward to the 15th and final season of Criminal Minds coming your way on CBS and CTV in the new year. Check your local listings. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. In the interest of time, kindly hold your applause until the entire program is over.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about happy childhoods, plus Ernie Smith from TDM is back on to talk about fax machines being used to send out news from newspapers. Think about that idea. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, plus much more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Just click on the Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify buttons located on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. And now, back to the stuff. On October 30th, Hudson, Florida resident 21-year-old Michael Salakis lost $1,000 in a card game to an unnamed man, which a witness told police upset Salakis. When the man was reported missing, Pasco County Sheriff's deputies started their investigation with Salakis, who told them the victim had dropped him off at his mother's house after the card game. So when the man turned up dead in a burned-out Ford Taurus, police visited Salakis' mother. During her interview, Salakis called his mother, according to court documents, and officers recorded the conversation. In it, he told his mom he had burned his legs throwing gas on the car, and they needed to coordinate their stories, so he was coming right over. When he arrived, police found a stolen handgun in his car, along with a cell phone containing internet searches for "Can you shoot through a seat?" and "How to treat burns." Deputies arrested him on weapons charges and later added first-degree murder, grand theft of a motor vehicle, and resisting arrest. You know, the one thing I find advantageous with modern technology is that you can go through a potential criminal's internet searches just to see how they thought of committing their crimes. Gone are the days when potential criminals were confined to figuring out the business hours of their local library. And a flight taking off from a Moscow airport was delayed for 20 minutes while the plane's crew chased down a pigeon that stowed away in the passenger compartment. The Aeroflot flight was delayed on November 9th at Moscow's International Airport when a pigeon was discovered on board. A video recorded showed the flight crew chasing the pigeon as it flies around inside the plane. The pigeon was eventually ejected and the flight departed. You know, I know there's a reason for all of God's creatures, but when I get to the part in the Bible that deals with Noah allowing in all animals in pairs, I still don't know why he allowed the pigeon on board. I mean, why are they here? What is their purpose? And in the case of this particular bird, this flying rat is just lazy, rude, and inconsiderate of the passengers on the flight. Pigeons can fly. People cannot. This is the equivalent of able-bodied people parking in a handicap zone. Anyway, let's move on. A 46-year-old man had a screwdriver pulled out of his rectum after pushing it inside himself and leaving it there for a week. In a disturbing case report, doctors reveal the man suffered a perforated bowel as a result and was left critically ill. He had arrived at a hospital in Florida with life-threatening septic shock because of bacteria which got into his bloodstream through the injury. But only when a CT scan was performed did doctors find the tool responsible, which measured 8.2 inches long and 1.1 inches wide. After removal surgery, the unidentified man needed more surgery to cut away rotting flesh from inside his buttocks after it became infected. Ooh. He survived and is believed to be the first reported case of this kind. Really? You have to go back in history to find others? I don't think so. It is not clear which end of the screwdriver was inserted first. It is also unclear why he inserted the screwdriver in the first place, but he has since needed treatment for psychiatric disorders. The story was detailed in the Annals of Medicine and Surgery. That's annals with two N's. Okay, let's pause here for a second, shall we? I search high and low through many news services, newspapers, magazines, and media outlets to find stories for this show. And I'm sure you've noticed when you find articles to read yourself, you often see links to other related topics either embedded or beside the articles you're reading. In the case of this story, I came across a companion piece with a headline in big bold letters that said, "What are the risks of putting objects in the anus?" Now, as someone who has worked in the media, I know that somewhere out there is an editor who never thought in a million years that he or she would go to work one day and write the headline, "What are the risks of putting objects in the anus?" Now, their life must be complete. Anyway, we have one more story in this section of Stuff File News before we get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. A Florida woman allegedly bit her boyfriend's penis and threatened him with a knife after she accused him of wanting to have sex with another woman. The alleged assault happened during an hours-long drinking session in Miami Beach that ended at about 3 a.m. 33-year-old Esperanza Gomez was drinking beers with her boyfriend when a female friend joined them around midnight. The friend left a short time later, but Gomez became enraged and accused her boyfriend of wanting to bed the other woman. She allegedly shouted at him, grabbing him by the arms, and began to poke him with a knife. She then bit his penis out of frustration. Gomez was arrested and hit with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. Okay. Call me old-fashioned and cautious, but if I was in a relationship and my girlfriend was poking me with a knife, this would be a warning that perhaps I shouldn't get my penis anywhere near her teeth. Ugh. I mean, that's common sense, isn't it? Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Is a happy childhood only a myth? When you talk to people, it becomes apparent that many folks grew up in dysfunctional families. It may make one wonder whether people who say they had a happy childhood are actually telling the truth to you and themselves. Conversely, if you actually had a happy childhood, could you continue to have one in adulthood? These are the questions we have for returning guest Anne Andrew, PhD. She's an author, former school teacher, and parenting coach. Her book is What They Don't Teach in Prenatal Class, The Key to Raising Trouble-Free Kids and Teens. She joins us once again via Skype from Vancouver. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Peter.
Nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
So we often hear this mantra about, oh, I had such a happy childhood, or I had such a dysfunctional childhood. Is it even a question as to whether the kind of childhood you had isn't just an experience, period? You had a childhood.
We certainly had childhoods. And what I've come to know is that we're all still recovering from our childhoods, whether we had happy childhoods or not. And I would be certainly a person who would claim to have had a happy childhood. I had two loving parents, and neither of them drank. And we didn't have to worry about where the next meal was coming from because my dad was a doctor. However, I grew up to be quite a depressed adult. And it wasn't until I was working with a therapist by the name of Diederik Walsack, who is the author of a book called Choose Again, Six Steps to Freedom. And I discovered that the root of my depression was actually in childhood trauma, but that those traumas were what would possibly seem rather trivial. And I gave actually this story the last time I was on your program about how I was traumatized by some pirates that jumped out of the bushes when I was digging for some treasure on Treasure Island as a kid at what was really a theme park. And I made up that I was stupid to believe that these pirates were real. And then that became a negative belief of mine that I'm stupid. And then I started jumping through hoops to get more and more degrees to try to prove to myself that I wasn't stupid, although this was really happening subconsciously. But what I also made up was that if I'm stupid, I'm therefore worth less, because someone who's not stupid is obviously worth more. And it also puts a kind of a barrier to love. So nobody could really love a stupid person. And so I also took on the belief that I'm unlovable, and blocking love is what we do when we're depressed. So in a sense, that really trivial childhood trauma, seemingly trivial, which was actually quite traumatic for me at the time, drove negative behavior later in life.
While it is important to look at one's childhood to see, I mean, you can't really know where you're going without necessarily looking at your past. But by also saying that, I'm reminded of a line in a television show that was on ABC, and I'm dating myself now because it's almost 30 years ago. The show was called 30-something. And I remember a line in the very first episode of that show, which ran for 4 years, where one of the characters turned to another and said, "Just how long is the statute of limitations on parental war crimes?"
And that's so brilliant because we actually give ourselves life sentences.
Yeah.
Until we challenge those beliefs. I had an experience last summer at a workshop in France where one of the participants, and this was a workshop on finding meaning in life. And one of the participants was actually terminally ill, and he'd been told he would be dead by January, and this was already June, so he'd outlived his sort of life expectancy. But he came to this workshop, and he came to the circle with a lot of fear, and we discovered through doing the six-step process that this fear was linked to him having found himself outside his house as a very young child. He was a sleepwalker. And it wasn't that he was afraid of the dark and being alone. It was that he was afraid of the punishment he'd get when he got back in. And so he actually processed that fear, recognized that he had always been innocent, that this was that the punishments that he had been receiving were because his parents were in a lot of pain. It had nothing to do with him, really. And yet he'd given himself this life sentence, and he kind of accepted his innocence the day before he died. He actually died the next day.
Wow.
So these really are life sentences.
You mentioned you had a happy childhood, and I feel I had an idyllic childhood myself. I really think I did have a happy childhood. Having said that, even if we have what we consider to be happy childhoods, do you find that we still manage to nitpick and hold on to things that might not be as idyllic as we wanted it to be?
Absolutely, we do. And sometimes it's even subconscious, so we don't even know that we're holding on to things. And what's great about doing this particular process that I learned through this therapist was that it takes any upset that we might be feeling in the present moment and links it to via a process of feeling into a memory. So every feeling that we have that isn't one of love, joy, or peace is actually linked to an episode in early childhood. That's where the origin is. And we find that we have these patterns of feelings, patterns of behaviors that result from those. So if I have a belief that I'm worthless, let's say, and anytime I see somebody not respecting me, I'm going to have a reaction to that. I'm going to get upset. That used to be one of mine, that I would generally yell, that would lead to a feeling of anger and frustration that would then lead to yelling. And I could only stop the yelling, not by behavior modification, but when I actually went back to the memory of being ignored by my mom frequently because she was actually deaf, but I didn't know it when I was very young. And that was where I got that particular belief.
So to paraphrase the title of an earworm from a Disney film, how do we just let it go?
Well, I think that it's actually wrong to just let it go. The better thing to do is to look at it and see where it's coming from, and then we can let it go. But we can't just let the feeling go, or we have to look at the belief and then we can let it go, because we have to, that the thing is that all of the beliefs that we pick up basically put us lower on a ladder than someone else. And so the correction to all of the beliefs really is understanding that we have inherent worth, that no one has more worth than anyone else. And that's the key. That's the real key to happiness, is understanding that we have inherent worth to the exclusion of all the other ideas about ourselves, that we're bad, that we're guilty, that we deserve to be punished, that we don't belong. These are the common ones that everybody seems to have.
Okay, so you had a happy childhood, I had a happy childhood, but there are some people who did not. However, as human beings, as time goes on, we seem to romanticize about things that were not necessarily that great, or might have been, a dire situation. You hear people who lived through the war and romanticize that time period. You hear people who lived through hardships and romanticize that time period. You often hear women who have multiple children who say, childbirth is horrible, but yet I seem to forget about it and I want to have more children. So why is it we manage to romanticize about things in the past that might not have been great at the moment, yet we still manage to nitpick and hold on to little things that traumatize us?
Right. And I think it's because sometimes we don't want to look at that. It's much easier to not go there. And actually, I can give you an incredible example. Diederik Walsack, who I told you about his book, his personal story is horrendous. And yet he will say it's never too late to have a happy childhood. And I was actually giving a talk on that topic to a group of seniors. And the day before, I called Diederik and I said, can you honestly tell me that you had a gloriously happy childhood? Or that you had a happy childhood? And he said, yes, gloriously happy. Now, he, when he was 3 months old, was interned in Indonesia. He was Dutch. And so he was in a Japanese concentration camp for the first 3.5 years of his life. And then when he was liberated, his parents weren't in great shape. And he ended up in foster care, where he was sexually abused. And then when the family was finally reunited, his father was very abusive and beat him quite frequently. And yet he reinterpreted by doing this process of looking at every upset, figuring out where it came from and correcting it, really accepting that he had inherent worth. And then he was able to recognize his parents' cry for love, or his dad's cry for love, and give love to that, and in his memory completely transform his childhood and recognize that in some ways it was a gift to him in order to heal the ideas that he had about himself, that he was monstrous, really. that he was responsible for the entire Second World War, which was actually a belief that he took on through all of this self-loathing, which builds up by having these beliefs repeat over and over to ourselves in our minds.
Is it possible that Dietrich, the person you're referring to, is just one of those people who has a positive outlook on life, generally, even with the hardships?
No, I don't think so. I mean, as an adult, he was suicidal before he got to this point of deciding that there had to be a better way, and then set about studying and looking at various spiritual paths. Actually, is the foundation of this kind of work. He was a bully. He grew up very angry. He had numerous marriages and was very self-destructive, alcoholic and substance abuse of all kinds. So I wouldn't say that he had grown up to be positive thinking. He just was able to completely train his mind to see things differently. And undo all of those beliefs that he took on as a young kid. And part of it is that between the ages of 0 and about 3, we're completely egocentric. So we see the world as if everything that happens around us is our fault. You know, so if we have a parent that is not happy, somehow we've done something wrong. Mm.
It's a fascinating topic indeed, and it's always fascinating to talk to you, Anne. I thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Anne Andrew, author of What They Don't Teach You in Prenatal Class, The Key to Raising Trouble-Free Kids and Teens. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the show number for this page, which is show number 0535, and you'll find links to Anne's website and also links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Listening to The Stuff File, now with 25% fewer calories. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll have another chat with Ernie Smith from Tedium talking about fax machines. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. But I've got one more Stuff File news story that I want to share with you here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio, and Spotify. Well, fellow Ambrivo was looking to bring home a 4-foot religious statue he says was stolen from his yard in Sorrento, Florida. To help with the search, he took to social media by creating a Facebook group asking if anyone had seen his statue. "My Jesus statue got stolen this weekend from my front yard," the post reads. It's a statue that's been in his family for generations. Now, what I'd like to know is, if he started the Facebook group immediately after Jesus went missing, or did he wait 3 days? If he didn't wait, all I can say is, ye of little faith. Anyway, Let's get to our last guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Ernie Smith, the man behind the website and newsletter known as Tedium, which is subtitled The Dull Side of the Internet, is back. This time around, he's here to talk about a recent newsletter that looks at an idea that really never took off, that being news outlets using fax machines to deliver their news to consumers. Ernie joins us on the line via Skype from Virginia. Hi, Ernie.
How's it going?
Great. Thanks once again for being on the program with us. Now, I happen to be one of those people that still has a working fax machine and I use it, so I found this article interesting. But what was also interesting and new to me was, again, like I said in the introduction, the fact that newspapers were looking at it as a way to deliver their product to consumers. How did that become a thing?
Well, you know, it's strange because it actually kind of happened twice. Basically, there was a period right before World War II where there were attempts to create a fax machine of sorts that used the radio to basically deliver electronically the news of the day. And then later on, about 50 years later, when fax machines via phone became more common, they started distributing news through that method as well.
Now, I understand when you talk about disseminating news via fax through radio, this was going back to a time when radio stations weren't 24 hours a day, so the stuff could be transmitted at night when radio stations were off the air, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Obviously, you had to have specialized equipment for it to basically make it work. There are actually two competing types of printers that were used. They were basically just giant radios that had an integrated printing press in them. One of them actually was made by RCA, and it was very much a experimental thing. It was shown at the World's Fair. And then there was an inventor named W.H. Finch who came up with another one. And both of these attempts, they were sort of like trying to make this thing happen. It was sort of a solution in search of a problem, because at the time, the traditional method of distributing printed newspapers was kind of working just fine.
Going back to, again, when radio tried to do this, or when newspapers tried to do it through radio, we're talking a period of time when, nowadays, we have media that seems to get along. But there was a time, and it wasn't that long ago, where radio didn't like print and vice versa. So I'm trying to figure out how, even though it was in the down hours when radio stations were off the air, how did the newspapers get the opportunity to try and transmit overnight via radio when, in some cases, radio was, by definition, their mortal enemy?
I would definitely say that there was an element of competition to it, in that it may have been startup publishers that were trying to do this. You know, kind of look at it this way: today, online media, anybody can start their own outlet. You know, obviously, this isn't exactly the same parallel, but it's kind of a similar approach. You know, coming up with a new technology distributed through radio that effectively publishes, you know, a newspaper. It's a very fascinating period. Obviously, you know, radio was still a fairly new thing. I mean, this was around the time that the television was first coming to life itself. So it was almost, in a way, it was competing with that to some degree.
Okay, so let's flash forward to a time when we actually did have fax machines. And again, as you were mentioning earlier, sort of the second wave of trying to get news disseminated via fax. Some newspapers actually tried doing this, and for a short period of time, at least in the test phase situation, were somewhat successful. What happened then?
Basically, it became a situation where a lot of businesses had fax machines, some individuals as well, but it kind of created a new opportunity to reach different audiences with information via fax. This was just before the time that the internet had taken off, and it involved basically sending out information to different types of people. It tended to target a lot of business people, and it was priced accordingly. A good example of this is the Hartford Courant, the Connecticut paper. they were one of the very first to publish, and they came up with something called fax paper. Initially, they tried to get customers to pay $2,500 per year to get daily faxes with the latest news in them. They were a little less successful. By the third year, they only had about 2,000 subscribers, and the price had fallen to about $600 per year by the time they shut it down. More successful was the New York Times, which created a product called Times Fax, which basically it kind of took advantage of the scale that the New York Times obviously has, you know, with the global reach and such. And they focused on a global audiences at first, along with like very niche audiences, such as say people on cruise ships, or the International Space Station has a subscription, for example. So they were much more successful, and you know, within a couple of years, they had something like 30,000 subscribers to the service.
What was the death of this? Would it be the internet, or would it be something I would consider to be more insidious, and that is someone else finding out that, hey, I can send information via fax, whether it's solicited or unsolicited? As I mentioned earlier, I still have a working fax machine, and nothing makes me more angry than someone else wasting my paper with theoretically junk fax.
I would say it was probably a combination of the two. You know, just think about it this way. You know, if you get a piece of unsolicited email, it doesn't really cost you anything other than, you know, a couple of bytes. it's not like a specific cost to it that's tangible. Whereas with the fax machine, you're obviously wasting paper. You're wasting, you know, you're wasting time that your phone line could be open, you know, things like that. And it was sort of a situation where, you know, the rise of junk faxes, it led to sort of the model kind of breaking down a little bit, because it kind of created a sense of consumer frustration around the approach. Like, it definitely made it so that commercial uses of fax machines became less prominent. I would say, though, that there were still success stories. I mean, the New York Times, strangely enough, their Times Fax service, which is now called Times Digest, still active today. I mean, like, they have an internet distribution arm, which allows them to basically send it via PDF or what have you. But it's managed to be the exception that basically proves the rule almost.
Hmm. Which had a longer life in that short period of time that fax machines delivering news was around? And the two things I'm talking about is, one is just that, fax machines delivering news. Or do you remember the short period of time when there was the electronic typewriter? Like after the electric typewriter and before the computer, this hybrid came along?
You mean like a teletype service?
Not a teletype service. The electronic typewriter, which was before the computer, but after the electric typewriter, this sort of futuristic typewriter came along that everyone thought was going to be great. And then it was, of course, wiped off the face of the earth by the fact that computers came along and just we didn't need the electronic typewriter.
Probably, I would say probably fax machines managed to eke it out just long enough, you know, because I think in part, you know, they were able to find their niches a little bit easier. Like one example I cite in my piece is a Montana newspaper created and had a relative amount of success with a publication that it called Fish Facts, which basically it targeted people that would travel to Montana for fly fishing purposes. And it had, you know, it reached its audience. And I think that, like, you know, kind of thinking about it in terms of like email marketing today, it kind of catches that same thing where you can sort of narrow as much as you need to. Obviously, the distribution is a bit cheaper with email than a fax machine might be. But that said, I would say that, you know, obviously the fax machine is kind of not a distribution method that's as widely used today as it once was, but it did probably have a period of about a decade where it was really you know, it was the way that some people did their thing.
Well, it's another fascinating item that you have on your website, which is Tedium, the dull side of the internet. I thank you, Ernie, once again for being on the program with us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Ernie Smith, writer of the website and newsletter Tedium. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is 0535, and you'll find links to Ernie's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
A Florida man pulled over Sunday night for driving recklessly told police that he needed to get home in a hurry because he was cheating on his wife. 52-year-old John Earl Picard was behind the wheel of a 2015 Honda going in excess of 90 miles an hour in a 55-mile-per-hour zone. When stopped by police at around 7:30 p.m., Picard was en route to his Palm Harbor residence following an extramarital tryst. Picard reportedly indicated his driving was reckless and endangering because he needed to get home in a hurry because he was cheating on his wife. Picard was busted for reckless driving, a misdemeanor, but when cops searched him post-arrest, they found a baggie with crack cocaine in his shirt pocket, leading to an additional felony drug possession count. Picard was previously arrested in March for domestic battery following a confrontation with his 55-year-old wife in their residence. Picard allegedly shoved and scratched his spouse during an argument. After Picard's wife requested that her husband not be prosecuted on that misdemeanor count, the case was dropped by the state attorney's office. Wow. I bet the wife isn't so much in his corner this time around. I mean, why? Oh, why? Would you tell the cops that you were racing home because you were cheating on your wife when such an idiot excuse is bound to be brought up not only to your wife's attention, but also the general public? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0534. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0534. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Any rebroadcast of this copywritten program in whole or in part without the express written consent of...
Oh, God, who the hell are we kidding? Who's going to steal this show? God, who writes this stuff? Holder, what a kidder.